Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. A History of Modern Britain in 20 Murders is the new book by Professor David Wilson. Delighted to say that David joins me live on the line now. David, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to you, Charles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, considering it's Wednesday. So the title sort of struck me as a really interesting. When you say History of Modern Britain in 20 Murders, are we talking assassinations? Are we talking what sort of? I mean, this might sound like facile, but what are we talking about when we say murders and the impact they have?
Okay, so this is not a history of murder. It uses murder cases to tell the story of Britain between 1885 through to the current day. And the irony about murder, because all murders are a tragedy, is that it forces the state to do something, which is that it forces the state to investigate how did these two people or other people come together and one or many of them end up dead. It forces the state to investigate. Therefore, there is a record that allows one to peer through the historical gloom to conjure up a picture of an ordinary life. Ironically, murder is one of those ways that we can begin to glimpse something about how ordinary Britons lived their life at different periods of time. And so the murders are simply of ordinary people and how they came to be in contact with with their perpetrator. And I zoom in on the murder and then out again so as to be able to show the culture, the economy, what society, how society was structured at that particular time.
Because it's interesting to kick off in 1885, because this is during the height of the penny dreadful and of that Janus-faced type of, of during the Victorian generation, where at one point we were all morally upright, but there was a dark side. There was a second side to this, which was, the crippling inequalities of Victorian society. And so there is almost a prurience, isn't there, in things such as the Jack the Ripper case, which still it has a fascination. I mean, when I was living in London, I used to drink in a place called the Admiral, and we used to see the Jack the Ripper tours going around. So even over 100 years later, people were still fascinated with this one particular murder. So why 1885? Is it because it's the Victorian age and it's the penny dreadful and media coverage?
Well, the media plays a great deal of importance in the story of Jack the Ripper. But I start in 1885 because it is the birth of tabloid journalism through the son of a Northern Baptist minister called W.T. Stead. W.T. Stead was born in a village called Embleton and moves to London, where he becomes the editor of the Pall Mall Gazette. And W.T. Stead invents tabloid journalism, although at the time he calls that the new journalism. And the first case that he really tries to use the Pall Mall Gazette as a platform on which to talk about morality is a media-generated cause célèbre about white slavery. But the key thing for me starting there was I wanted to bring in the idea of tabloid journalism and how that has an impact on why the story of Jack the Ripper becomes part of public consciousness in the way that you've described.
Is it because it's the illustrator? And I just love the idea of the Pall Mall Gazette being a tabloid. You'd expect it to be this very sort of straight up broadsheet, wouldn't you? Just with births, marriages, and deaths. Things like the Illustrated London News, you have these sensationalist, you know, maidens or, you know, ladies of negotiable virtue being sort of snatched and dragged down alleys where unspeakable things will be done to them. It's the purines, but it's also there's an underlying sort of almost pornographic like in what the illustrations are showing, because they can't use photographs, obviously. It's 1885.
Well, indeed, the Pall Mall Gazette was a staid, respectable gentleman's magazine until it became edited by W.T. Stead. And his new journalism captures the public's attention, and also, because it captures the public attention and leads to increased sales for that staid gentleman's magazine, other journalists began to do the same. Now, I would say quite quickly that W.T. Stead was a very moral man, and he was just using justified sensation to not only gain the attention of the public, but also to force the state to take action, because there were people marching in the streets as a consequence of Stead's campaigns against white slavery and so forth. But the book itself, Giles, is we start in 1885, and obviously that is about the Jack the Ripper murders. But I end by talking about the murder of Sarah Everard, and again, a young woman murdered in the streets of London in 2021, but murdered not by an unknown serial killer, but murdered by a serving officer of the Metropolitan Police. And I zoom in to the circumstances in which Wayne Cousins abducts and murders Sarah, and then zoom out again to talk about whether or not our police, British police, are the best in the world, one of the myths that we tell about ourselves. I zoom out to discuss misogyny, the violence against women, and I zoom out again to really talk about what our police do and who they should be accountable to.
And the other thing is the fact that these horrendous crimes have the power to stop society in their tracks. I'm 57 years old, okay? So in the early 90s, I was, you know, making my, you know, my way as a journalist in the UK, in London, and everybody stopped with the murder of James Bulger because it was so horrific that we couldn't comprehend. And sort of 30 years later, people looking back and go, oh, well, the 80s and 90s were a generation. As all generations do, it was better in my day. But I remember the incredible soul-searching and where have we come as a society with that image captured on CCTV, and then to find out the perpetrators of the horrendous crime, and if you've read the details, they are horrendous, were no more than boys themselves.
Well, I don't want to trivialize this at all. My first response to what you've just asked me, but you don't look like 57. Can I just assure you?
Clean living and regular prayer, David. That's what I meant.
And the book covers the murder of James Bulger, because what I wanted to, because you're quite right, James Bulger murder does something in the political process that sees the Labour Party, which had always been seen as rather soft on crime, hardens up as a consequence of James's murder, as a consequence of Tony Blair, who at the time was Shadow Home Secretary. Little known fact, Tony Blair, our Prime Minister, never was actually Home Secretary. He was only ever the Shadow Home Secretary. But Tony Blair, using a soundbite that was given to him by his friend Gordon Brown, comes to prominence by saying New Labour is going to be tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. And that soundbite captured public consciousness in much the same way as I cover other cases around that period, such as the massacre in Dunblane, and then later in the millennium, the spree murders in Whitehaven by Derek Bird. Which is actually, when I was doing the research for that particular set of spree murders, seemed to me to have not been covered in British history at all.
Again, obviously, Dunblane, again, I know exactly where I was. I remember the shock of sitting in, once again, in a pub somewhere in Battersea. And people were saying, I've got kids that age. And the whole thing with guns, and it brought around an immediate change in who could own guns, etc., straight away, because it was the absolute shock and horror that this could happen. You know, this could happen in the British society. We know we are now inured, we are now almost anaesthetised by the slayings in the States that come. But to have this happen in a small, sleepy Scottish town, you know, in a primary school, seemed inconceivable. But there was an immediate reaction to that in terms of legislation.
And of course, the interesting thing in the book, I try to compare our reaction to Dunblane to what happens in Whitehaven when Derek Bird, a taxi driver,
right,
goes on a rampage through Cumbria, shooting people at random, having started by shooting his twin brother, the family solicitor, and then shooting people that he had worked with, and then simply driving through the countryside. And what was interesting when I really started to look at the public reaction, Thomas Hamilton, who was the gunman in the Dunblane massacre, is presented immediately as odd and an aberration within the community, whereas Derek Bird was seen very much as one of us. Mm. Derek Bird was seen, and both men legally owned the firearms with which they killed people. So what the book is trying to do is really try to understand what can we say about Britain as a country and the British as values, based on not the great and the good, not the stories of Winston Churchill or Margaret Thatcher or whoever it is that we usually tell the story of Britain about, but the story of the people who are living ordinary lives and who tragically lose their lives to a murderer.
But one of the things is, and on the three cases that we've mentioned, this one, Sarah Everard, killed by a policeman, a serving policeman, somebody we're supposed to trust. Dunblane, in a primary school, in a school, for goodness sake, where our children are supposed to be, you know, we drop our children off every day at school and they are safe and they're with teachers, and we do not think, we could not imagine that sort of thing happening. The Jamie Bulger case, and excuse me going for a bit left field here, but I remember it stuck with me over the decades, but somebody, and it might have been somebody in the Daily Mail, saying, it looks like that picture, the last picture you see of Jamie Bulger being led away, it looks like the famous image of Cliff Clark's shoes with two little boys walking off, and it's that holding hand image which really shocks. He's not being bundled, he's not being abducted, he's being led away by the hand. And that, again, cuts to the core of who we see ourselves are. And again, if you go Victorians, it was in many cases, it was seen as, well, these are lower class, these are prostitutes, these are working class, these are people from the slums, therefore they have a different set of values, life isn't as important to them. But it is, and it does, and we have to look at that, David.
Absolutely. And you're also right, I think, to talk about the images, because that image of James being led away by his two abductors and murderers is one that I think is seared into our national consciousness. And one of the things I try to do, though, within the book, is talk about murder more generally, because I think people, Giles, are aware that 9 out of 10 perpetrators of murder are men, but they are less aware that 7 out of 10 of the victims of murder in Britain are men. Now, that's not to deny, and I've acknowledged, the misogyny that exists in our society against women, but murder is so often a male phenomenon, and it is a young male phenomenon. The group of people who are normally murdered within Britain are aged between 16 and 24. So murder really is about young men predating on other young men. And that leads me in the book to discuss masculinity and how masculinity has historically been conceived of as singular, whereas one of the things that certainly happened in my lifetime is that we now see murder as a plural. There are multiple masculinities, multiple ways that men can behave as men.
Men behaving as men. Did you find, in the aftermath of the Great War and the Second World War and during the Blitz, there were blackouts. This was the perfect time to commit all sorts of murder. All sorts of crime, excuse me. Can you argue that people were desensitized? I mean, here's the flip side. Having gone through the horrors of total war, were people more respectful of life, or does this not even equate, or were they again anaesthetized to killing because many people had seen so much killing, or had killing via bombing or whatever, sort of visited upon them?
The three current origin myths about Britain and the British stem from what happened during the Second World War. The origin myths of Britain and the British are as a consequence of Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, and the Blitz. We're all in it together. We are a David against a Nazi Goliath. We are peaceable people, and if only you could leave us alone, we will live our lives with decency, honor, and civility. And our inspirational wartime leader, Winston Churchill, sums up what Britain is and who the British are meant to be. But remember, I'm writing a book about crime. I'm writing a book about murder. And one of the things that the book goes into is the fact that the crime rate rocketed during the Second World War. And I was able to uncover an autobiography left by the leader of what we would now call an organized crime group, a gang, a man called Billy Hill, who ran, his gang was known as the Heavy Mob, who had a wonderful modus operandi when he was committing crimes. He would dress his gang in air raid precaution warden uniforms, and he hired a fleet of ambulances. And as soon as the bombs started to fall, he would send out his ambulances and his gang in air raid precaution warden uniforms to go to the bombed out buildings where the bombs had just fell, and they would loot the buildings. And the disguise was so successful, he writes in his autobiography, that the members of the public started to help them put the loot in the back of the ambulance. And Billy Hill said the Blitz were his halcyon days, the golden days when he could commit crime hand over fist, and he wanted the Blitz to come every single month. And so for Billy Hill, you suddenly gain a picture of people not all being in together, but some who were quite clearly for themselves.
It's interesting you mentioned that as well, because that's another great thing that we romanticize in all aspects of our media, of our novels, the whole thing. You know, the glamour of the gangster, the code of honour amongst thieves. And if you ever had any dealings with those involved in organised crime, they can be, the harsh reality can come as something of a shock to you, Professor.
Well, you know, one of the things that I also felt very much as you just posed, I felt, Giles, that if I just used the source of Billy Hill, that people might say, well, he's a gangster, isn't he? He would say that. So I looked at a lot of our war records that are collected, and I came across an account by an unemployed actor called Ballard Barclay. And Ballard Barclay would dance the night away in the Café de Paris in the 1940s, in 1941. And the Café de Paris was where the jeunesse dorée of English society would go and drink champagne and eat oysters, even as the bombs were falling. It just so happened that one night there was a direct hit on the Café de Paris, and many, many people lost their lives and many others were injured. But Ballard Barclay survived, and he produced an account which is searingly visceral about what happened. He writes, and I'm quoting him directly, it took only 2 minutes before the looters arrived. And then I heard people scream because they were cutting off the fingers of the dying so they could steal their rings. And so Ballard Barclay gave me an insight into what Billy Hill, the gangster, was saying, but from his perspective, as somebody who had survived a bombing and was watching looters steal jewelry and actually attacking the dying who were lying there injured.
And also, of course, it's the Café de Paris. It's full of quote-unquote toffs. So perhaps
yes. This
is a case of, well, you know, there's, you know, that, you know, it's, they've got more, even if, you know, if they don't make it, fine, nobody know. And if they do make it, well, they're from rich families, so they can always buy another set of jewellery.
You know, what was interesting, though, Giles, I went down one of those rabbit holes you do in research, because I wanted to know, well, who's this guy Ballard Barclay? Who is this unemployed actor who's left us incredible account? Did you ever watch Fawlty Towers?
I live my life by the teachings of the major, David.
And Ballard Barkley is indeed the major in Fawlty Towers.
Exactly. So there you go. Unfortunately, I cannot quote many of his favourite lines because we're in 2025. But yeah, he was once voted by Loaded Magazine greatest living Englishman at that point, the major in Fawlty Towers. That's Ballard Barkley. Absolutely wonderful stuff. When you write a book like this, how difficult is it to leave it alone in terms of, because, you know, I speak to many psychiatrists, not on a personal level, though some say I should. I think to many psychiatrists and therapists who deal with criminal cases and deal with murder, and they say that it's very difficult to leave the impression it has. It's not the sort of thing that you put away and don't think about. It's not a book about butterflies of the Southwest. So therefore, when you're writing a book like this and you come to stories like the Café de Paris or Brides in the Bath, just give me a quick one about the Brides in the Bath. Again, that's a case that really is, you know, sort of it stays with you, doesn't it? It's like Bulger, like Everett, like Stephen Lawrence, for example. They stay with you.
Well, firstly, I think maybe I should write a follow-up called Butterflies of the Southwest.
Yeah, exactly.
But exactly. Maybe we should co-author it. I use the story of the Brides in the Bath to talk about the position of women vis-a-vis the law and the law of coverture, whereby the legal personality of a woman was completely subsumed by the legal personality of her husband. And that's why Chapman, who was the guy that was killing his wives in baths, was drowning them because he could then inherit everything that they had. He just would move from one woman to another so as to make money. But I use that story also to talk about another British myth, because, of course, everybody always believes that somehow DNA, forensic science, DNA is the solution to the amount of crimes that are committed. And that's embedded in British consciousness, partly because of my dear friend Amelia Fox and Silent Witness, I always say, but it's embedded in public consciousness. And actually, DNA leading to outcome. DNA evidence leading to outcome in a criminal case is 1%. It is largely irrelevant as a crime-fighting tool. And yet it's embedded in public consciousness because of the myth of the forensic scientist. And, of course, the Brides in the Bath case was the beginning of a forensic scientist called Bernard Spilsbury, who comes to public attention by demonstrating how it was that Chapman was killing his wives without leaving any telltale signs. And so Spilsbury is the beginning of this myth of the forensic scientist is going to solve crimes. And that would bring us into the current day about DNA and the DNA national database and so forth.
How many of these, because again, we get, thankfully, most of the population get their information on murder via novels, newspaper reports, TVs, movies. And the serial killer is always this, this sort of deranged genius, this evil, you know, we need an evil genius and all these are protagonists. How many of the, when you look at these cases, have been premeditated, and how many are, you know, what the called French would call, you know, crime personnel? I mean, are they heat of the moment stuff? Are you looking mainly at the premeditated ones? Are you looking at the ones that where somebody snaps? I mean, you suppose you can say, you know, the murder in the Highlands with, you know, with a guy driving around the taxi is somebody snapping rather than premeditated. I mean, and what does that say about? I mean, is it the Michael Douglas, you know, falling down moment?
A slight correction. Remember, he wasn't driving around in the Highlands. He was driving around in Cumbria.
Sorry, my bad.
And obviously, I write a great deal about serial murder and interview. I've spent my life as an academic and as a practitioner dealing with lethal violence, men who've used lethal violence. And so often lethal violence is about 5 minutes of madness. It's young men predating on other young men in 5 minutes of madness because somehow they feel they have been disrespected in some way. And the way that they believe that they can regain their respect is by lashing out, and in that 5 minutes of madness, they kill somebody, often somebody that they know. And in the book, I use the story of Jimmy Mizzen, who's a 16-year-old man who's murdered, well, boy, really, 16-year-old boy, who's murdered by another young man in a bakery in South London. But what I'm choosing to do, Giles, is not talk about serial killers or the kind of spur-of-the-moment crème de pastel. All I'm seeking to do is find the lives of ordinary people whose murder can somehow stand for the bigger issues, the bigger cultural issues that are ongoing in Britain at the time that, tragically, they lose their lives.
So what should we take, then? Should we take the fact that, you know, the past is not a rose-covered land where, you know, sunny uplands and people riding quietly through villages with bicycles with baskets on the front and everybody having respect for their elders, etc., you know, coppers giving a clip around the ear? Should we look more dispassionately and more realistically at the past, because it will always be like this, or it has always been like this, and unless we seriously think about who we are, it will always be like this?
Well, there's an there is an overarching narrative that I had to read 300 secondary history books so as to be able, because, you know, I'm a criminologist, I'm not a historian, so I read a copious number of history books that cover the period of Britain between 1885 to 2025. And there's an overarching narrative. And then a narrative goes something like this, that Britain is in decline. Britain is going to hell in a handcart. And the reason for that they're in decline and going to hell in a handcart is because some group is othered, which is causing that problem at that particular period of time. And in the 1880s, it was Irish Catholics.
The hooligans.
And then, as we go through history, the Irish become the Italians become the Maltese, and currently it's the Albanians. There's always a group that is somehow leading to Britain being in decline. And that what I'm trying to show is that the British that emerge from those histories aren't kind of hobbit-like creatures. Even when we were at war, even when we were supposedly standing alone, Britain owned 25% of the world's landmass. We were reliant on the empire to provide foodstuffs, to provide manpower often, to fight battles, rather than being David fighting the Nazi Goliath. I mean, I understand why people believe that. Britain was still an empire at that particular time. And the British who emerged from this history are far more complex, far more black and white, far more messy in terms of the people that we are, and far more diverse. And yet the Britons have been shoehorned into a caricature of having stiff upper lips, standing alone, being peaceable, hobbit-like creatures that inhabit someplace called the Shire. The Britain that emerges from a history of Britain in 20 murders is far more complex, far more messy, and as a consequence, far more interesting.
The book is called A History of Britain, of Modern Britain in 20 Murders. It is by Professor David Wilson, who I'm speaking to today. But listeners, go onto the Talk Radio Europe website. You'll see the front cover. Click on the link, and a well-known delivery company, probably based on the South American River, will get it straight to you. David, if people want to find you online and say nice things to you, where's the best place to find you?
Oh, I'm on Instagram, I'm on TikTok. I'm currently on tour, Giles, going throughout Britain, talking about the issues that we've just been talking about. And I'm speaking to you from day 8 of that national tour, 28 days. And I'm speaking to you from the mighty city of Glasgow. Tomorrow I'm in Stirling, then I'm in Edinburgh, then I'm in Newcastle, Manchester, Sheffield, Cambridge, all points south, finishing on the 15th of October in London.
And if you're looking for somewhere to have a book tour, A, Glasgow, because my mum's from Coatbridge, and B, also Stirling, because if you want murder and intrigue and people standing, Stirling Castle's a wonderful place to do it. The book is called A History of Modern Britain in 20 Murders. It's by Professor David Wilson. Professor, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Lovely talking to you again, Giles. You take care. 57, can hardly believe it.
Well, yeah, as I said, clean living and a regular prayer. Let's not even go there.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.